But today is VE Day. The war is
the
over.
The crown queen waves from the Belt.
Eagle has landed. Apollo 11 has landed.
Tearing down the Berlin Wall.
Since 1929, the Monks Investment Trust's mission has been to help investors grow their wealth. We aim to do this today by taking a three-dimensional approach to growth. Cyclical growth, rapid growth, and steady growth.
The World Wide Web.
Wall Street is in turmoil as stocks crash.
The Monks Investment Trust, managed by Bailey Gifford. Capital at risk.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to The Advice Show. I'm Zach, a reporter at New Model Advisor, and welcome to the latest monthly roundup. Joining me today is data reporter Alicia Hagopian and senior investments reporter Nicola Blackburn.
Hello.
Hello.
Guys, welcome back to the podcast. How are you doing?
We're doing great, Zach. How are you doing? Where have you just been?
I have just come from the Labour conference, which has been extremely exciting. We've had a fair few events and conferences on, I think, since we last spoke. The CSI had a conference the other week. We also had the New Model Advisor Investment Retreat. So thank you to everyone who attended that. But yeah, the Labour conference was really interesting, guys. I mean, we had the Conservative conference the week before, but we sent me to the Labour conference this time around. It was super interesting, extremely fun. I mean, you got the sense of a party very much preparing for power. Of course, they are urging caution and whatever, but the facts are that they are leading in the polls quite considerably. They spoke a lot about the economic situation that they expect to inherit, basically. So sort of tampering down expectations, really. The main two things, really, economically, from the Labour conference were the lifetime pensions allowance, which they've pledged to reintroduce previously, and rumours around Conservative scrapping inheritance tax. And I'm sure we'll get into those. But a couple of words on the conference. I mean, yeah, unfunded tax cuts was mentioned quite a lot, a reference to Liz Truss, of course. There was a massive emphasis on a fully costed manifesto coming up. It was quite interesting because so when you go to the Labour conference, they send you a massive programme, like a really thick book, which I'm led to understand is much thicker and much bigger than any previous conference programme. Mm-hmm. The reason being is because the policies are such a blank canvas. And everybody's there trying to shape policy. So, I mean, going there were all sorts of societies and, you know, fun fairs and whatever, sort of like at university when all the societies try and get you to join, right? Because you're an IE fresher. You got a sense of a blank canvas. And to be honest, Keir Starmer's speech did give off that effect for me. He spoke a lot about the possibilities and the situation we're going to inherit. And he spoke about some specific policies, but to be honest, he didn't really, beyond the house building project GMB Energy, the energy company they'd like to create, there wasn't massive amounts of specifics on economic policy. And I think the reason for that is because, as they kept repeatedly saying at the conference, the situation they inherit will be quite bleak economically. There were Conservative plans rumoured to scrap inheritance tax. Now, we don't know if this will go ahead. These are very much rumours. They've denied it since. And Chancellor Jeremy Hunt has explicitly said it would be virtually impossible for any tax cuts to be enacted, particularly when, of course, their priorities are getting inflation down due to the cost of living crisis. It's very interesting that this is being rumoured. If it is the case, it would be, of course, just a general election push of needing something exciting economically to really push those polls back into conservative favour. The lifetime allowance for pensions removal, of course, by the Conservatives was quite significant. And Labour have previously pledged to reintroduce this. Of course, this would be, you know, reintroducing a tax on the wealthy in many people's eyes. So it's traditional Labour sort of heartland, really. But recently they've been very quiet on that. And I put out a story just the other day about how, since Rachel Reeves pledged that back in March, we haven't actually heard anything from Labour on it, which is quite significant given that, you know, it was quite a loud thing to announce at the time. And I think that's reflective of the changing economic situation, to be honest, and them trying to assess what they can actually pledge and what they can't. But I gather that John Schaefer on our Wealth Manager publication also wrote a story on the inheritance tax.
Yeah, he did, Zach. And it's a really interesting one for our readers because a huge number of their clients will be invested in IHT products that are supposed to mitigate that 40% tax that they would otherwise have. John's article, you know, raises the question that if if the IHT is to be abolished, then will there be a huge run on IHT investment products? That could cause liquidity issues. That could cause for a huge kind of loss in value in that huge market of AIM listed products that's actually got a lot more popular in recent years. And what will that mean for advisors and their clients' investments? There's a whole other realm to this, right? Which is, you know, yeah, this has been rumored for a while that a cut to IHT could be, you know, a last ditch attempt on Sunak's part to sort of win favor and for the Conservatives. But advisors, they have to advise on certainties. They can't advise on, you know, a possible tax, like change to tax policy, because their job would be very complicated if they did that. So this is creating complications for them in several ways. And that's what John's piece looked at for advisors and wealth managers. I think as well, you know, John talked to some product providers who, you know, one of whom sort of argued that this was unlikely to happen or it wasn't something that they were looking at yet. I think this raises a broader question for the advice market of, you know, are they going to use these products as much going forward? Because governments can always tinker with tax rules. Mm. So definitely read John's piece.
One of the things as well from the Labour conference they were desperate in repeating was their line on CEOs and senior business leaders want stability. And they don't. And one of the things they criticised the Conservatives for was the swapping of ministers, the hiring and firing of the cabinet repeatedly. And they argued that Labour would be better placed because we're going to be, they're very much presenting themselves as this stable force. Mm. So yeah, that's really interesting.
I think it's interesting as well. I mean, from the topics that both of you have brought up, of that at the end of the day, it's not as simple as this, but definitely inheritance tax and also the lifetime allowance are being used as a bargaining chip on both sides in a way. Mm. So it's really difficult to say what will actually happen. And I think it is something that our advisors should maybe, you know, mentally start preparing for both, but should definitely hold off on making any sharp decisions or, you know, and definitely calming down their clients, because it must be difficult as a client seeing these changes. Say you're approaching retirement in the next 2 years, you're thinking, is all my retirement plan about to be changed? But at the same time, you really can't say that for sure, because I don't think either government has a serious intention to make those changes immediately. I think either way, it would be maybe a slow process. And another thing that you mentioned, Zach, is about how at the Labour conference, there was not actually that many, we're not actually that many economic themes discussed. And I think that that's something that we also saw at the Conservative conference, that there were a few topics that were notably not really on the table. So it's really hard to say until the election actually happens what Treasury changes will happen. So I think, we shouldn't sort of play the game of predicting, maybe.
No. Yes. Well, I mean, of course, they were very happy to talk about the economy in broad terms, in terms of jobs, in terms of rebuilding homes and things like that. But of course, for advisors, yes, for things that affect advisors, it was much less specific. I mean, you know, I went to a couple of talks as well where the FCA were there and they were mentioning some of the work they've been doing as well on the advice guidance boundary and together with shadow economic ministers talking about how seriously they're taking their work in terms of improving regulation and their work in being an outcomes focused regulator. I mean, they've been really busy this last month, right?
Yeah, the FCA has been really busy in the past few months since we last spoke. We were just talking earlier about how there's been a lot of fines and bans that have come through. Some of those from, you know, really legacy things from a few years ago, actually.
Yeah. Some of the like biggest British Steel fines or sort of decision notices that they've issued have come out within the past few months. We've seen a couple. So,
yeah. So the regulator is definitely very much getting back into the swing of things following a more quiet period during summer, I'd say. And on what you were mentioning, the advice guidance boundary, I was also at the PIMFA conference earlier this month or last month, where Lucy Castledean from the FCA really sort of hammered down on that point about advice guidance and said that the paper could lead to a wholesale restructuring of the regulation around advice. So I think that's really something to look out for, especially because we're in such a changing landscape at the moment. I mean, you know, we've heard a lot about the idea of finfluencers and online things that are sort of sold as advice but aren't really advice. And I think the regulator is very aware of the fact that it needs to catch up with the level of maybe fraud that is out there. Yeah. And it, on a similar note, also the FCA cracked down on a few crypto asset firms recently, I think I saw. And so I think, you know, the regulator is very much going into the 21st century, not that it already wasn't, but I think understanding that things might be moving at a faster pace than they can keep up with.
I do recall as well at a conference last month, the FCA very much talking about data and the amount they're gathering, the analysis that's required. And, you know, on that, we're hearing from a lot of advice firms about the information requests they're getting from the FCA. These are of a surprising scale even to them. So that they're asking for a lot more information, to put it bluntly, but also over a longer time period. So, you know, your standard advice firm might expect the call from the FCA every once in a while of, can you give us everything in the last 6 months, be it on client files, on fee charges, on whatever, really. But what I'm hearing increasingly is that those are getting expanded to 2 years, 1 year, 2 years. Mm. Now, it's slightly unclear at the moment whether these are spot checks on advice firms, just picking them at random, or whether it's something that the FCA has noticed and thought, we need to dig deeper. Because obviously you can't, the FCA can't be, you know, asking every single advice firm for this. It's just not feasible. However, it does raise questions, of course, that of a massive amount of data gathered, will they be able to process this information effectively? And will every advice firm be able to provide it? You know, I've heard a lot of cases where advice firms have been able to provide it, which is fantastic. But of course, it raises questions that, you know, is the FCA going to ask a small business to provide this this amount of data, and would the small business be able to provide it in time?
And I think, like, you know, it's for advice businesses, it's understandably really tricky to keep up with what is widely accepted as like a tightening of regulation that we've seen over the past few years that's affected advice businesses. But if you look at this from a glass half full perspective, hopefully this, the FCA is kind of increasingly kind of just increasing requirements from advice firms, the increase of just rules for them will actually provide an opportunity for them to hopefully become a bit more confident in their offering and provide clearer guidelines for what they do offer. I think, like, going back to what you were saying before about the advice guidance boundary becoming a, you know, a bigger theme, like, will that open up? I don't know what you guys think, but will that open up more opportunities for advice businesses to provide a guidance offering as well as their advice offering? And if there are clearer rules on what guidance is, hopefully that will help them.
Definitely. Well, I've certainly heard from sort of investment platforms and those kinds of people that they would like to provide more, but they don't know if they can because it will be classified into that advice section. Right.
It's too soon, isn't it? Yeah, yes. It's too early.
And in terms of filling that advice gap, and in terms of getting more people receiving just financial help, really, whether you term that as regulated advice.
Yeah.
That's why the FCA is so determined to get this boundary right, so more people can get financial help that they need.
And there are we've heard from advice businesses that we speak to, advice firms, that they're offering products onto the market that deliver some kind of like simplified advice. We profiled a advisor who started up his own business last week, and he said that in future he would like to, you know, develop a kind of app that would help with the advice process. You know, there's opportunities for things like that. He's got a small new IFA at the moment, and he's already thinking about that as within the realms of possibility. So it's, you know, some exciting stuff.
I think it's interesting because all these things that we're talking about, advice guidance, and also consumer duty and data reporting requirements. So Next Wealth just came out with a really in-depth and sort of widespread report about the advice industry.
The consultancy.
Yes, the consultancy Next Wealth. And I think that a really key point from the report is, so consumer duty obviously forced firms to reassess their value for money offering. Now we're about, 3 months in from it, 2-3 months. Mm. And actually, the report shows that for the first time in at least 5 years, the average advice fee has dropped from 2% to 1.75%. And I think that's a real shift, actually, and shows that whether firms will stick with that or not, consumer duty has made an impact already, and that firms have been preparing for the sort of regulator scrutiny. But I think that something that the report discusses, which is very important, is that the average advice fee has dropped across the UK, but costs are not down really at all. And Heather Hopkins said that, you know, the cost of compliance and also the cost of different technologies and data reporting have actually meant that even if it's just temporarily, cost for advisors running a business might be going up, but the cost of advice is going down. So it really sort of begs the question of how are advisors going to be able to run their businesses? And the answer is that, of course, some of them will, but some of them might be squeezed out by this period of change. And as a result, there has been an increase in advisors looking to sell, but also advisors looking to sell in the next 18 months. And according to the survey, 8% of advisors weren't just looking to sell, but looking to exit the market entirely, which I think is a really, really interesting figure, because it's sort of some advisors, not to say all advisors, but some advisors thinking they're just going to throw the towel in and walk away from advice because it's not necessarily viable option for them. And I think that's a really interesting phenomenon that we might be seeing in the next few years. I want to know what you guys think of that, whether that's some conversations that you've been having with advisors.
Not about advisors leaving, to be honest, but in tandem with this, we are seeing an increase in like diversity and things like fee models and you know, business models that new advisors are bringing to the market. So some advisors are finding a way around it. Having said that, you know, so for example, we hear a lot about the subscription fee model. A lot of those businesses are in their first few years of being operational. So I think the success of them long term remains to be seen. It's an interesting problem, Alicia.
On that note, there definitely has been a lot of consolidation in the last few years, because, you know, there are some people who believe that scale is the way to make an advisor business profitable. But that consolidation tended to be at maybe a mid range of the market. But so, for example, a sale that we saw recently was Jill Thomas selling her advice firm Future Life Wealth Management to the private equity backed consolidator Amber River.
And was that like a kind of mid sized firm?
It was a 330M
okay
business, and also a top 100 company. So a top tier advisor, and she was looking to sell her business, but she had, you know, some, according to her, some very high requirements for who would be a good partner. And I think it's interesting to see that, because that is a sort of upscale business, but looking to exit under these market conditions. And another interesting thing about that is you have a private equity backed consolidator, which doesn't really have a big media presence, doesn't publish a lot about its acquisitions. But actually, we've been running our private equity database, Zach and I, and since the last time we ran the report, which was earlier this year, the firm has already added another 2 billion of assets under advice. So that's an interesting one to look out for, because actually the private equity backed consolidators are making quite a lot of moves, and you might not be hearing about them, but you know, within a year or so, it might be a name that we hear a lot of Amber River or some of their other competitors. So I think there actually might be a trend towards a bit more consolidation following consumer duty. We might see a bit of a influx of that, but that doesn't mean that, you know, the traditional smaller IFA model is going to be wiped out. We just might see a shrinking of the market a little bit.
Yeah. What you said before about Jill Thomas having some, you know, really specific kind of requirements, you know, obviously for the business that was going to buy her business, is really interesting, because if you flip this around and look at it from the perspective of the advisors who are looking for potential consolidators, if this is a really hot market in terms of the private equity firms, the asset managers who are looking to acquire advice businesses, then they can probably afford to be a bit picky and choosy, right? I mean, they can kind of court businesses, they can you know, decide what they want, and often in this market, I've heard that if your business is approached by a interested acquirer, potential acquirer, you know, don't you have a duty to your clients, your colleagues at executive level, and, you know, if they're there, your shareholders, to consider the benefits to those shareholders of an acquisition? Like, there's opportunity here for advisors, and we may come onto this, but we're reviewing entries to our top 100 advice firm list for 2023 at the moment. A lot of them have said that their succession plan, you know, when it comes to be, will be about consolidation. And one of you made the point before, I think, that if you're an advisor who is clocking that as what will happen in future, but you're not planning on retiring for 10, 20 years, you have a lot of time to court the market and see who the big players are out there that, you know, you think look good.
That's a really good point. And there definitely are a lot of options out there at the moment.
Mm.
You know, we probably at some point will see consolidation within, between the consolidators. But right now, mm-hmm. there are definitely a lot of options. And I think if you're a more upmarket advice firm, you or smaller IFA, you should definitely be considering those options. And
yeah.
I mean, lots of different surveys have showed that actually at least half and maybe even the majority of IFAs in the UK have been approached about acquiring their business in the last year. So that, you know, people are out there, people are looking for your business in most cases. Well, that actually, you know, brings to mind another story of the merger between Succession and Aviva.
Yes.
So that's on a much larger scale than the things that we've been talking about.
Yeah. This acquisition happened formally just over a year ago, and it was a huge bit of news. Succession are a big national advice firm. Aviva, huge insurer, huge asset manager that people all know, advisors know very well. And we wrote an analysis piece looking at the success of that acquisition 1 year on. And this acquisition is a really interesting case study for what can go well and what cannot go so well when, you know, an acquisition of this scale happens. So what was kind of raised from it? I mean, the first thing is, you know, the point that from an acquisition of scale, you're always going to have some cultural clashes. We've seen 50 advisors exit Succession over the past year. A big chunk of those were advisors that were retiring. And so it might have been attrition that Aviva expected, but some of them decided to go to other firms. These were top earning advisors at Succession who would have had huge client bases. So you might automatically think, right, what a blow for Aviva. That's a lot of clients and top advisors lost.
Yeah.
But on the flip side, you know, Succession have acquired other advice firms since then, which means they would have brought in new clients and new advisors. For Aviva, that probably means that in terms of the profit hit and everything, that balances out. So from Aviva's perspective, that might not matter. So the question for Aviva is it still meeting its targets that it expected to meet went before it acquired Succession? Potentially, the acquisition has led to a lot more flows onto Aviva's platform. At the same time, Succession hasn't hit and doesn't expect to hit its EBITDA targets for 2022 and 2023. It was actually going to give a lot of its planners bonuses if it did. But despite it doing that, it is still going to give its planners those bonuses. These acquisitions, you know, they're never smooth sailing.
Do you think that, you know, like you said, a lot of Succession advisors leaving, do you think Aviva might have actually priced that in when they bought the firm?
Great question. I think you would assume that for the advisors that were going to retire, yes, for the ones that decided to leave in the year preceding because they were always promised share payouts at the time of acquisition, maybe not. But you would think that a consolidator would do their due diligence and realize that if a lot of top shareholder advisors are going to receive those long-awaited payouts at the point of an acquisition, you know, that was in the contract, like at the point of sale.
Yeah.
They might have anticipated that, but that's a lot of advisors to leave in a short period of time.
Yeah, yeah. And in terms of, you know, any sort of cultural issues that may have arisen, you know, we've seen, I think Wealth Manager had a massive piece out last month about Evelyn Partners and the struggles there of a merger. and of some potential cultural difficulties arising there. I just wanted to know, you followed Succession for a while. You know, how much attention do you think is given to the culture of firms fitting? Of course, that sounds like a stupid question, because every press release I read from an acquisition says we're looking for a good cultural fit. But of course, we're talking about a lot of money at play here, so there's various different things that come to the table. Mm. I just wondered what your thoughts were on those fits and, you know, how they can be prevented.
I think it's incredibly important from a strategic business perspective. In Succession's case, their top shareholder advisors, who had the largest client banks and were bringing in, you know, they were the top fee earners, bringing in the most money from those large client banks.
Mm.
A lot of them have left. Now, we haven't spoken to all those advisors.
Yes, of course.
So we are not jumping to conclusions that that is all about there not being a cultural fit. But, you know, if an advisor is unhappy, they're going to leave.
Mm.
So, and if those advisors are the top advisors that are most valuable to the business, then that can be a serious hit to the bottom line. Now, Succession has the backing of a huge insurer now. It's making acquisitions. That's going to help it if it is hit with such a hit. But, you know, if you're a mid-sized advice firm and you're independent and there's a cultural shift and that happens, that's going to have huge consequences for your business. So I really don't think the importance can be understated. And, you know, there are events that can cause a lot of cause a cultural drift. I mean, Succession, a big event that happened to them in the past year was they had a big cyber attack.
Mm.
And there has since been a kind of a group claim, or there's a claims company that is has called out to people affected by that, both advisors and clients, and said, get in contact if you are really worried about the impact of this. And, you know, that's huge for Succession. Succession also, following the cyber attack, its chief technology officer left. So again, another senior exec, you know, big mistake, and then they've departed. So, you know, yeah, these things, you know, people don't forget about them.
Mm.
That, you know, another major event that happened recently, or perhaps a future major event, is rumors that Aviva will be put up for sale.
Mm.
How do you think, I mean, there's a few questions about that, but since we're talking about Succession, how do you think that could sort of resonate within Succession's advisors?
Yeah.
Or among Succession's advisors?
Yeah. I mean, it could go one of two ways. If the whole business is sold, which I've been speaking to a few people, we think that is unlikely, probably less of an impact. If Aviva is split up and a proportion of the business is sold, that could have more of an impact. If it's life and pensions, which covers advice, it covers the wealth business, and that's sold off, that will surely have kind of a ripple effect down into the entities within Aviva. If Aviva sold off, let's say, its insurance business, its protection business, that would give it more energy, more resources to hone in on its remaining businesses like life and pensions, like Aviva Investors, which provides the funds and investment solutions. So that, you'd think, would have positive benefits for its advice arm. Something to add about Aviva is that in previous years, they have done a huge kind of consolidation of their most profitable, their like core businesses. They've sold off 8 global businesses in various regions. I think, you know, Hong Kong was one, Poland was another. So they've made moves to like focus on their most successful businesses. So they're no stranger to doing that. And as I said before, when we were discussing advice businesses, if an offer has come on the table, if an acquirer that's interested has approached them, they have a duty to shareholders, to their clients, to their investors, to consider those offers. So watch this space, I'd say.
That sounds like a great note to end on. Thank you both so much for joining me. You've been listening to The Advice Show with myself, fellow reporter Alicia Hagopian, and senior investments reporter Nicola Blackburn. For any questions, please feel free to tweet us at New Model Advisor or email us at nmateam@citywire.co.uk. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you next week.
Since 1929, the Monks Investment Trust's mission has been to help investors grow their wealth. We aim to do this today by taking a three-dimensional approach to growth. Cyclical growth, rapid growth, and steady growth.
The World Wide Web. And Wall Street is in turmoil as stocks crash.
The Monks Investment Trust, managed by Bailey Gifford. Capital at risk.